Listening Comprehension Test. You will hear each recording twice. After each listening, you will have time to complete your answers. Task 1. Street Trees. You will hear a podcast on trees in Detroit. While listening, answer the questions. You need not write complete sentences. Unless otherwise specified, name one aspect. You now have time to read the assignment.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Jason Goldman. Trees in cities do measurable good for biodiversity and for human health. They scrub pollution from the air. They provide habitat for wildlife. They make streets look nicer. And they even reduce stress and have been linked to reductions in crime. Back in 2015, a group of Toronto-based researchers discovered that planting just 11 more trees per city block could reduce heart-related conditions by the same amount as if everybody living on that block became a year and a half younger. But in Detroit, between 2011 and 2014, a quarter of eligible homeowners turned down an offer from a local nonprofit for free street trees. Ironic, considering Detroit's nickname was once the City of Trees.
It was actually over 1,800 trees that were rejected out of an eligible 7,425. So it was a big enough issue at that point where it warranted further investigation.
Forestry researcher Christine Carmichael, who did the research at Michigan State and has since moved to the University of Vermont. The nonprofit created an education campaign to get more residents to accept the free trees. The assumption being that if people had all the facts, they'd be more likely to take the trees. But when Carmichael talked to residents, she found that they understood the benefits of trees. Their unease was about trust.
Basically, what I found was that opposition in Detroit to tree planting among some of these residents resulted primarily from negative past experiences with street trees, particularly in low-income neighborhoods that were grappling with blight from vacant properties, which created an additional burden of care for their neighborhood.
In the last half century or so, more than 500,000 Detroit trees died from disease and neglect. It was primarily low-income African-American communities who were forced to deal with the consequences and the hazards, like falling limbs, posed by dead trees. In speaking with residents, Carmichael found that they would be more willing to accept free trees if they could be more involved in the decision-making process. Locals wanted input on tree size and whether they produced flowers. They also very reasonably wanted to avoid trees that could drop rotting fruits or sap on cars and sidewalks.
Now listen to the recording again.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Jason Goldman. Trees in cities do measurable good for biodiversity and for human health. They scrub pollution from the air. They provide habitat for wildlife. They make streets look nicer. And they even reduce stress and have been linked to reductions in crime. Back in 2015, a group of Toronto-based researchers discovered that planting just 11 more trees per city block could reduce heart-related conditions by the same amount as if everybody living on that block became a year and a half younger. But in Detroit, between 2011 and 2014, a quarter of eligible homeowners turned down an offer from a local nonprofit for free street trees. Ironic, considering Detroit's nickname was once the City of Trees.
It was actually over 1,800 trees that were rejected out of an eligible 7,425. So it was a big enough issue at that point where it warranted further investigation.
Forestry researcher Christine Carmichael, who did the research at Michigan State and has since moved to the University of Vermont. The nonprofit created an education campaign to get more residents to accept the free trees. The assumption being that if people had all the facts, they'd be more likely to take the trees. But when Carmichael talked to residents, she found that they understood the benefits of trees. Their unease was about trust.
Basically, what I found was that opposition in Detroit to tree planting among some of these residents resulted primarily from negative past experiences with street trees, particularly in low-income neighborhoods that were grappling with blight from vacant properties, which created an additional burden of care for their neighborhood.
In the last half century or so, more than 500,000 Detroit trees died from disease and neglect. It was primarily low-income African-American communities who were forced to deal with the consequences and the hazards, like falling limbs, posed by dead trees. In speaking with residents, Carmichael found that they would be more willing to accept free trees if they could be more involved in the decision-making process. Locals wanted input on tree size and whether they produced flowers. They also very reasonably wanted to avoid trees that could drop rotting fruits or sap on cars and sidewalks.
Task 2. Border. You will hear a radio report about life on the Mexican-American border, with the cities of El Paso on the American side and Juarez on the Mexican side. While listening, tick the correct answer, A, B, C, or D. There is only one correct answer. You now have time to read the assignment.
Youth Radio's team covering the border spoke with young people from El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, who grew up never seeing the border as a dividing line. Billy Cruz reports.
Along the dry, rocky desert of El Paso, past all the food chains and shopping malls, a brown fence stretches for miles. Antonio Villaseñor Baca is 22. He was born here in El Paso, a huge borderplex that spans the Rio Grande River. But he has an uncle in Juarez, and growing up, Antonio's dad would take him back and forth a lot.
You know, like if you want to go out and party, you go to Juarez. You have family in Juarez, but you live in El Paso or vice versa. It really seems like just a huge hassle to, like, go through all of this stuff at the border.
For young people like Antonio, life on the border isn't just about the momentous crossings we read about in the news. Commuting between two countries is a part of everyday life. There are even kids with dual citizenship who live in Juarez with their parents and cross the border to go to school.
It's really weird because growing up as a kid, there's just other kids in your school. And it's not until you get older that you start seeing, well, it's the kids who speak Spanish who are doing the daily commute.
Many people and goods flow between El Paso and Juarez every day. The culture and economies of both cities rely on each other. 23-year-old Kenya Guerrero is part of that flow. She grew up in Juarez, but just finished college in El Paso. And she crosses the border every day to help out at her parents' cowboy boot shop.
Yeah, so we are at the Santa Fe Bridge. This is in the central part of El Paso. As you can see, like, cars are coming in from Juarez. It usually takes about half an hour to 3 hours to cross El Paso.
To make her commute easier, Kenya got something called a sentry pass, which cuts down the time it takes to cross. Thousands of people in the El Paso-Juarez region pay the fees and go through the background checks to get one. Kenya says she feels equally at home in Juarez and here in El Paso.
It was pretty normal, and now it's not like that anymore because you're sometimes afraid.
Now, Kenya has to be extra careful whenever she crosses, because she says agents have gotten stricter since President Trump took office. If she's caught with a prohibited item, like even an apple she packed for lunch and forgot to throw away, Kenya could lose her fast pass. Recently, she had a close call.
I had a crushed candy in my cup holder, and the agent asked me, is that cocaine? And I got nervous, not because it was cocaine, but because it's just a question, like, how can he think that I'm bringing cocaine?
Now listen to the recording again.
Youth Radio's team covering the border spoke with young people from El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, who grew up never seeing the border as a dividing line. Billy Cruz reports.
Along the dry, rocky desert of El Paso, past all the food chains and shopping malls, a brown fence stretches for miles. Antonio Villaseñor Baca is 22. He was born here in El Paso, a huge borderplex that spans the Rio Grande River. But he has an uncle in Juarez, and growing up, Antonio's dad would take him back and forth a lot.
You know, like if you want to go out and party, you go to Juarez. You have family in Juarez, but you live in El Paso or vice versa. It really seems like just a huge hassle to, like, go through all of this stuff at the border.
For young people like Antonio, life on the border isn't just about the momentous crossings we read about in the news. Commuting between two countries is a part of everyday life. There are even kids with dual citizenship who live in Juarez with their parents and cross the border to go to school.
It's really weird because growing up as a kid, there's just other kids in your school. And it's not until you get older that you start seeing, well, it's the kids who speak Spanish who are doing the daily commute.
Many people and goods flow between El Paso and Juarez every day. The culture and economies of both cities rely on each other. 23-year-old Kenya Guerrero is part of that flow. She grew up in Juarez, but just finished college in El Paso. And she crosses the border every day to help out at her parents' cowboy boot shop.
Yeah, so we are at the Santa Fe Bridge. This is in the central part of El Paso. as you can see, like, cars are coming in from Juarez. It usually takes about half an hour to 3 hours to cross El Paso.
To make her commute easier, Kenya got something called a sentry pass, which cuts down the time it takes to cross. Thousands of people in the El Paso-Juarez region pay the fees and go through the background checks to get one. Kenya says she feels equally at home in Juarez and here in El Paso.
It was pretty normal, and now it's not like that anymore because you're sometimes afraid.
Now, Kenya has to be extra careful whenever she crosses, because she says agents have gotten stricter since President Trump took office. If she's caught with a prohibited item, like even an apple she packed for lunch and forgot to throw away, Kenya could lose her fast pass. Recently, she had a close call.
I had a crushed candy in my cup holder, and the agent asked me, is that cocaine? And I got nervous, not because it was cocaine, but because it's just a question, like, how can he think that I'm bringing cocaine?
Task 3. Ship. You will hear an interview with Sam King, one of the passengers of the Empire Windrush, a ship that took about 500 people from Jamaica to Great Britain in 1948. While listening, fill in the missing information. You need not write complete sentences. Unless otherwise specified, name one aspect. You now have time to read the assignment.
It is 1948 in Jamaica, and the island is in bad shape. It's still recovering from a hurricane a few years earlier, and Sam King remembers the economy being in a desperate state.
Things, again, were very bad because the coconuts were destroyed in 1944. It takes 5 to 6 years for the coconuts to rebuild. The old structure of farming was undermined. I didn't see any future. Of course, my father was very glad I was there because I'm the eldest son. And like him, eventually I would take over the farm to pick pimento and to plant banana and all that and all that. But I had no intention of planting bananas.
Back then, Sam was just 22 years old, but he'd already seen the outside world. He'd volunteered during World War II and served in the Royal Air Force in Britain. With the coming of peace, he'd return to the hills of eastern Jamaica, but he knew he wouldn't stay. And within months, he spotted a chance to get away.
It was in the Daily Jamaica newspaper that this troop ship would call to Jamaica in about 2 weeks' time, and the passage was £28.10. Let's get that straight. The average man didn't have £28.10. It was equivalent to about 3 cows.
So you're sitting reading the newspaper, and what goes through your mind?
I'm going back to England.
Eventually, nearly 500 passengers boarded the ship, bound for England and a new life. They would turn out to be pioneers. Their journey marked the start of a new wave of migration. In the decade to come, 250,000 West Indians would follow in the wake of the Windrush. Sam remembers the mood that evening when she slipped slowly out of Kingston Harbour.
People were waving, things were happening on the docks. No, for about half of us, we had no intention of coming back to a colony. We were looking forward, we were looking towards a new home. But there were some men in their 40s who had a wife and children. They were looking back at yard. They were waving, they were that. But we, chiefly the young ones, were not looking back. We were looking forward.
Several stowaways had managed to smuggle themselves on board. One was a woman, and out of kindness, Sam and some of the other passengers clubbed together and paid to buy her a ticket, enabling her to make the voyage legally. But conditions on the troop ship in those first years after the war were far from luxurious.
Sad to say, you have mashed potato in tins from New Zealand 2 years. They put it on the table, mix it up with water. Now, if you didn't heat it then, in the evening they mix it with cabbage. And if you didn't eat it then, in the morning they fried it and call it bubble and squeak. You have to eat it sometime, but food was rationed in Britain. Men were playing dominoes and things, but we had the decks were chiefly blankets and a few bunks, but the women were in cabins. So we just mill around. In the evenings, they have boxing competition and things like that, and dance and all things. But the main thing is, it was to mentally get yourself ready to land.
And the other young guys who, unlike you, hadn't seen Britain before, were they asking lots of questions?
Time and again, they would come, Sam, what will happen? Will I have a job? They were more concerned about a job. I said, settle down. In the evening, after supper, about 6:30, I would go in the lower deck and I would have 8, 10 of them. I said, look, food is rationed in England. You can't grasp that. But work is all over the place, so work is not the problem.
Now listen to the recording again.
It is 1948 in Jamaica, and the island is in bad shape. It's still recovering from a hurricane a few years earlier, and Sam King remembers the economy being in a desperate state.
Things, again, were very bad because the coconuts were destroyed in 1944. It takes 5 to 6 years for the coconuts to rebuild. The old structure of farming was undermined. I didn't see any future. Of course, my father was very glad I was there because I'm the eldest son. And like him, eventually I would take over the farm to pick pimento and to plant banana and all that and all that. But I had no intention of planting bananas.
Back then, Sam was just 22 years old, but he'd already seen the outside world. He'd volunteered during World War II and served in the Royal Air Force in Britain. With the coming of peace, he'd return to the hills of eastern Jamaica, but he knew he wouldn't stay. And within months, he spotted a chance to get away.
It was in the Daily Jamaican newspaper that this troop ship would call to Jamaica in about 2 weeks' time, and the passage was £28.10. Let's get that straight. The average man didn't have £28.10. It was equivalent to about 3 cows.
So you're sitting reading the newspaper, and what goes through your mind?
I'm going back to England.
Eventually, nearly 500 passengers boarded the ship, bound for England and a new life. They would turn out to be pioneers. Their journey marked the start of a new wave of migration. In the decade to come, 250,000 West Indians would follow in the wake of the Windrush. Sam remembers the mood that evening when she slipped slowly out of Kingston Harbour.
People were waving, things were happening on the docks. Now, for about half of us, we had no intention of coming back to a colony. We were looking forward, we were looking towards a new home. But there were some men in their 40s who had a wife and children. They were looking back at yard. They were waving, they were that. But we, chiefly the young ones, were not looking back. We were looking forward.
Several stowaways had managed to smuggle themselves on board. One was a woman, and out of kindness, Sam and some of the other passengers clubbed together and paid to buy her a ticket, enabling her to make the voyage legally. But conditions on the troop ship in those first years after the war were far from luxurious.
Sad to say, you have mashed potato in tins from New Zealand 2 years. They put it on the table, mix it up with water. Now, if you didn't heat it then, in the evening they mix it with cabbage. And if you didn't eat it then, in the morning they fried it and call it bubble and squeak. You have to eat it sometime, but food was rationed in Britain. Men were playing dominoes and things, but we had the decks were chiefly blankets and a few bunks, but the women were in cabins. So we just mill around. In the evenings, they have boxing competition and things like that, and dance and all things. But the main thing is, it was to mentally get yourself ready to land.
And the other young guys who, unlike you, hadn't seen Britain before, were they asking lots of questions?
Time and again, they would come, Sam, what will happen? Will I have a job? They were more concerned about a job. I said, settle down. In the evening, after supper, about 6:30, I would go in the lower deck and I would have eat 10 of them. I said, look, food is rationed in England. You can't grasp that. But work is all over the place, so work is not the problem.
This is the end of your listening comprehension test.